When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
Welcome to the Invested Podcast, where we're figuring out investing. That's how we're doing it here, is we're figuring out investing.
Yeah.
Since there's only really one definition of investing, frankly, and that is you buy something that you understand, which is fundamental, to knowing what it's worth, and you pay less than it's worth. That's investing. And ideally, you're looking at something that will be an investment you can hold forever. That would be the ideal. Perfect investing would be finding something that is such a fantastic business that it produces a tremendous return on capital, all the money you've got in it, your return on equity, return on invested capital, of 20%, 30% a year or more every year, and it just stays up there and it just keeps going. And there are a few companies that have done that, a few. And that's all we need is a few.
Yeah.
Mostly investing for most of us amounts to not being able to pick something that perfect, since there's very few of those and who knows which ones they are. It consists of be sure you're buying something with a big margin of safety that you understand. And then very likely what will happen if you're right is that the economy or the market or the industry or that company's problems will fade, and the stock market, which tends to be rational much of the time, will reappreciate the value of that business and put its price back up where it should be, in which case, if you've gotten a big margin of safety, you've just doubled your money. And you've done that in a year or 2 years or 3 years, something like that. That's what we try to target.
So easy and so simple, what else would we have to talk about for the rest of the semester?
As Charlie says, it is simple.
You started
but you
out
threw
going
in the word invest- easy.
You're right. I did. That was not fair. We're just understanding investing. It's so simple.
It is so simple. Yeah, it is simple. By God, it is simple. So's the idea that, you know, if you want to make a lot of money, buy low, sell high. That's simple.
Well,
not
you know.
Easy.
Yeah. Not so easy. We've got.
Which is, by the way, why we focus on rule number one, which we haven't spoken about for a little while. Well, there's two rules of investing, according to Warren Buffett. Rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one.
Yeah.
So effectively, and this is what a lot of people fail to really understand on a deep level, is that really all you're doing is trying to prevent losing money when you're investing. That's your main, I would almost say your entire focus.
Let's talk about that today in a very real way.
Okay.
Because I think we say that a lot, but thinking about that in all sorts of permutations is important. So we have a great question today from Oliver, who's a listener, and I'm just going to play it. Sound good?
All right. We like your questions, you guys. Send them in to, where should they send them?
Go to investedpodcast.com, which will forward you to my dad's website, which is Rule One Investing. And there on the podcast page, there's a spot where you can submit your audio question. We really enjoy getting them because I have a lot of the same questions as you guys, and it's really nice to hear it.
And don't speak too longly when you're asking
well,
the question.
This one's a little long, so.
Okay.
Chill yourself there while you listen.
All right, here we go.
Hi, Daniel and Phil. This is Oliver from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. First of all, I just want to say I'm a longtime fan. I bought the book Invested back in 2018, and it has benefited tremendously. It's sort of become the key to the financial door for me that I was looking for. Through your book and your podcast, you know, I learned about Buffett, and then I've always a letter printout in binder sorted by years. I also found out about Ray Dalio. I got his book, Principle. And then that not only changed my views on finance, but also my views in life and work. And I find a lot of these principles that you mentioned in your book and podcast is also applicable to my life outside of finance. So I just want to say a big thank you. It is an understatement to say that your book and podcast has changed my life for the better. So my question to you guys is that with 2021, whereas in such a high PE ratio and everything in the market is so overvalued and the Shiller Index and Buffett Index so high, it's really hard for me to buy anything in the market with a margin of safety. And then with Ray Dalio recently saying, don't own cash is trash, and don't own bond, you know, with the inflation on the horizon, I'm not sure what to do with my capital. I'm a small investor. I can't buy gold. I'm worried that all my cash is going to be eaten away by inflation, but I don't want them just sit in my saving account in my bank. So I was wondering if I can pick your brain, Phil and Daniel, what are some investing move I can do in 2021 with such a turbulent market as we see last week with, you know, GameStop and all the market craziness. So I want to see what you guys take on this for small investor like me and many of your podcast listener. What are some investment strategy for 2021? Thank you.
Thank you, Oliver. I think that is such a good question. And I also really loved hearing that the ideas that you're learning around value investing have applied to your life outside of investing, because I think that anybody who starts to learn value investing discovers that, and it's so nice to hear.
I agree. I think that Li Lu, who's, you should read everything that Li Lu ever writes or talks about, phenomenal investor who is in the Rule One movement, if you will, who basically said that investing is about figuring out what you love, what you're passionate about, and then magnifying it. And it's so true. It, like, the values that you bring to investing will get magnified in your investments, and they'll get magnified in your life, and it changes everything. It really makes you a different person.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of ways, it makes you a better citizen and a better person.
What you put your focus on grows, and it's transformative. It was for me to put my focus on companies with great integrity, creating great products and services, and it changed the way I think about where I put my money in all sorts of contexts. So Oliver's question is, cash is trash, guys. What the heck? Basically. And hearing Ray Dalio say that inflation is coming, Ray Dalio is not the only one who's been saying that. We've all been hearing it. And just wondering what to do when the advice is, don't buy bonds. He doesn't think he has enough money to buy gold. And stocks are at all-time highs by most metrics. So considering that interest rates are insanely low, and until that changes, one could probably expect the market to keep going up, what to do? And I think it's a great question. What to do when the market's up, you don't really see any other options, and you're holding cash, right? And cash may not hold its value, is what he's asking.
Oh, cash will not hold its value. And that has been a problem now for, 40 years, easily 40 years. And you could really make a good case that it's been a problem since 1935, when the United States started devaluing the dollar. And it's been an unrelenting devaluation ever since. We've talked about that a little bit already. So I think it's instructive to kind of just look back and see, what did Buffett do? You know, we get a little bracelet, WWB. And we look and see what happened.
And it has to
be
a bracelet made by Borsheim's jewelry store.
There you go.
If they don't make that, they're missing out on a branding
opportunity. You know, I just discovered something. I'm honestly, now this is after me being a total fan of this guy for 40 some years, and I'm rereading the letters. Okay, rereading.
Yeah.
And every time I reread these letters, and yes, you are too. It's super good. I always get something new out of it. And one of the things I got out of this was that Borsheim's, you know, Mrs. B, Mrs. B with the Furniture Mart.
Yeah.
Okay, that's her daughter's business, Borsheim's.
Oh, I haven't made it to that letter.
Her son-in-law got into the jewelry business.
And
Buffett said, you know, why not make, you can't make too much of a good thing, right? So he loves the family, loves the work ethic. And that family, I don't know if you've ever been, you've been into Borg Shops. We went in it together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the most different jewelry store I've ever been in. It's phenomenally interesting to me. I mean, they pull out, maybe it was just because it was during the Berkshire meeting, but God, I mean, they got stuff. They got a lot of stuff, a huge inventory, which is one of the secrets, by the way, of both the Borsheim and the Furniture Mart, is that they have gigantic inventory. They tell the truth about it and they keep their prices lower than anybody in the country. And they just have one store. That's it. Come to us. We're not coming to you. So
yeah, I think the reason they had all that stuff out was because it was Berkshire, and
probably, you know, so.
I wonder. It'd be interesting to go in there actually, not during that weekend,
and we'll see
if it's really different, and if they really have sales during the Berkshire weekend or not. I'm sure they do. Integrity, well, remember? Integrity.
Integrity.
You can't say it's like TJ Maxx always, or TJ. What's it called in the UK? TJ. I don't know. I forget. Anyway, it's called something similar in the UK. Discount stores. They always say like 25% down from, you know, original price, but then they lie about the original price and mark it
lovely
up.
So coming
anyway,
back to, coming
cash
back
is
to
trash.
Oliver, coming back to Oliver, cash is trash. All right. And yet Warren Buffett today we know has over $150 billion in cash. So what this seems contradictory, and it is to a certain degree. Because Buffett also says he never tries to predict the market, has no idea, never will try to predict the market, where it's going and all this, which I find a little bit disingenuous, because he's done extremely good at predicting the market more than once by having a lot of money in cash when the market crumbles. And so I think it's not trying to predict the market so much as just not being able to find great companies at a great price.
I think those things look the same.
Yeah, they look the same. But what Oliver's asking is something we can actually find out about. What did Buffett do in other times when he's just been massively in cash? And there's a he writes about it, I thought, in the 1987 letter, but it might have been 86 or something, right in that time period. I haven't had a chance to go back and find it. But he talks about how how he basically invests in stocks, bonds. And he hasn't talked about bonds in a lot of years, but back then, stocks, bonds, and what he called workouts, or in other words, or arbitrage. He basically got around to calling it arbitrage. And his view was, in that time period, he doesn't really care which one it is. They're just going to go to the one that offers the best deal. I want you to remember, 1987... bond returns in some cases were 15 to 17% a year in relatively low risk bonds. In fact, the US government 30-year treasury bond hit 15% per year back in the mid 80s. And at that point in time, good investors like Buffett were pretty much neutral on whether they wanted to be in the market or wanted to be in bonds. If they got a good deal on a corporate bond, they bought it.
So much, much, much higher return than right now. Is
oh,
what you're
saying. Yeah.
Like by 15 times, basically.
Oh, gigantically better returns. Right now, you can't really go to bonds, and no one would encourage you to do so, because they're very unlikely to go down further, although that can happen. They can go negative, but not a lot further. And very likely that they'll start.
How does that inform what he does with cash?
Okay. So remember now, there's basically these three places to put money: stocks, bonds. Well, cash would be the fourth. So stocks, bonds, or arbitrage. And Buffett described arbitrage as being a perfectly useful place to put the money when you have an edge. And the kind of arbitrage he was talking about is when company A decides to buy company B and form a merger. And what happens often is that company A will offer, let's just say the example he was using is $37 per share to the owners of company B. Okay. I think this is kind of how it works. So company B, so basically company B is going to sell for $37 a share being offered by company A. And company B at that moment is selling for $33 a share.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason company B doesn't immediately go upon the approval of this deal by the board to from $33 to $37 is because there is a catch. And the catch is government approval hasn't happened yet. The government can get involved here, claim monopoly problems and whatever. So there's issues, and the shareholders haven't yet completely gone along with the deal. So there's issues that could derail the deal. So there's a spread. A spread is a price differential between the price that company A is going to pay and that company B is selling for today. And that spread, if you buy company B and hold it, eventually, if you're right, it'll sell for $37. And that spread right there, that $4 spread, is an arbitrage. It's basically a time and deal arbitrage. Effectively saying there's no reason this shouldn't go to 37. It's going to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to make $4 on it. Well, that doesn't sound like a lot, right, on a $33 investment. But then time comes in as a factor. So, okay, how much time before this all happens? And the answer might be 3 months, in which case that little 11% return just became 33% compounded on an annualized basis. See, you see what I'm saying?
I do.
And Buffett would load money into these deals. He would pile money in when he found them. And so he would do it when he found them if he had an edge. And the edge would be understanding these two companies well enough and understanding what the approval process looked like well enough that you could make a reasonable estimate of probability of the deal going through.
Sure.
Okay, now I'm getting into the weeds here, Oliver. I know. But I just want you to understand what another great investor does with his capital when he was much, much smaller. Okay, so now they can't do these deals because there just aren't any of a size that would affect Berkshire at all today. But back then, they could find them at a size. And by the way, you know, obviously all of us, we could do these kinds of things all day long because we're small. If you wanted to get good at this, of course. Now, there's a couple of things you need to know in order to make a judgment about whether this is a good deal. And one of those things is understanding how you would come up with a probability and why probability is important in understanding whether you should do the deal.
Can we just back up for 1 second before we get into probability
really
of the
get
deal?
Rolling.
Yeah.
Oh, darn.
I want to hear all about it.
About this for years.
I want to hear all about it. But the question is about cash, and you're talking about
moving cash into
speculating on mergers.
It's a bet.
So. Right, yes. Speculating.
Right.
So are you suggesting gambling. To give this an umbrella headline? Are you suggesting that one thing you could do with your cash is put it into short-term speculations on which you think you have an edge?
Yes.
Understood. Okay.
Well
thank
done.
You. Headline.
I guess I could have said that in one sentence like that. But yes, that's precisely right.
So now, what that says to me is you have to be willing, before we get into the probability, I want to hear all about it. You have to be willing to put your cash up in a risky deal.
Yes,
I mean,
you do.
That's essentially the answer is you stay in cash and you wait it out, which right. is risky in a different way.
Right.
Or you try to alleviate the differential by making some shorter term speculations.
That's right. You're making
interesting. Not what I thought you were going to say at all, Mr. Investing is the only way to go. Don't ever talk to me about speculating.
Well, you know, when you're teaching somebody to drive, it's different. You teach them different things when they get better and better, right?
Yeah. Is one of those things. The this fundamentals of driving are not correct.
And it's just that this, you know, you have to keep it simple when people are just starting to learn. And we've been doing this podcast for 5 years, and I think it's probably time we can expand a little into this area, because it is a fundamental to what we're doing in the markets right now. The markets have become overpriced substantially by the standards that we would look at. And obviously, if interest rates are going to stay at 1% for our lifetimes, you know, for your lifetimes, then the markets are not particularly overvalued right now, because there's such a massive, just you can pay much more for a risk asset if a non-risk asset is only available at 1% than you can if a non-risk asset is available at 6%, right? So, by the way, imagine if a non-risk asset is available at 15%, what you're going to require the stock market to do. And of course, when that happens, the stock market is toast. It just, people pull their money out because they can't see any way that a stock market could give you a risk return that would justify that.
I think, frankly, any announcement that interest rates are going up a quarter of a percent is going to cause a bit of a panic. But
well, I think that there has been a movement on the 10-year T-bill of darn near 300% upward.
Yeah, but I'm talking about like policy.
Right. If policy changed, then you'd have another story. Yeah. But back to this thing.
Okay. So now the probability
portion. So I'm not going to try to teach you guys how to adjust probability here on a podcast. It just doesn't work. But let me just say that it's pretty straightforward. There are formulas that you use, which we teach during class about how to discover the probability of a risk asset with a high degree of certainty. And that's the key to what Buffett was doing, is having a high degree of certainty around the probability. So right now, we've always wanted a high degree of certainty around the business that we buy. Okay, that is, this business is 100% certain to make money, and I'm about 100% certain that it will, okay, over a long period of time. Excuse me. But now we're going to have a high degree of certainty. I'm almost 100% certain that I've nailed the probability that this will work out as a 90% probability. That's a whole step removed, right? It's a whole another thing now that we're trying to project what the likelihood of this gamble working out is. So what probability is just simply that, the likelihood that this gamble is going to work out well. And what we want is we want gambles that have a probability of 90% or better of working out. Ideally, 95%. The ones that we do on the last, I think, since we really started keeping good records on this stuff about last 8 years, we've averaged about a 95% probability of success on these kinds of things. Now, we don't do, excuse me. We don't do a lot of merger, and this is called merger arbitrage, by the way. We don't do a lot of merger arbitrage, have done some in the past, and we may be doing more in the future as mergers continue to just skyrocket with these low interest rates. But mostly what we do are put type options on companies we want to buy, companies we'd like to own. Similarly to doing merger arbitrage on companies we really understand, often companies we want to own, and they're merging together. So I think that's about as far as I want to go with that. I'm sure that's going to generate a lot of questions, but the essence of it is it can be done with enormously high probability of success. When Buffett, and by the way, you don't do too many of these, you do a handful of ones you really understand, and you try to make sure you're not wrong. And so I think we tend to use about 20% of portfolio to do this kind of stuff in this kind of a market. So we're using substantial amount of cash that we have excess on to do this. And think about it. If we're using 20% of the portfolio and we're making, let's just say, 25% on it, the only real limitation on doing that with the entire portfolio is it's hard to find these deals. So you look hard to find enough to do 20% on. So if you do 20% and you're making 25% on that 20%, you're effectively making 5% on the entire portfolio.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Right? And that puts a base under the portfolio that adjusts for currency.
So, I
think you're seeing the point.
So yeah, I get the point.
At a 5% currency deflation rate, currency will be cut in half in 15 years. It'll buy half of what it buys right now in 15 years. I don't think we're going at that rate at all. But assume we were, this would be keeping up with it. We would be keeping our entire portfolios up with the loss of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I feel like sort of talking about it like that and not really getting into it is just frustrating. So, it takes a good amount of time to find some of these things sometimes. Not always, but
I agree when it comes to merger arbitrage. Now, of course, the problem with merger arbitrage isn't finding them anymore. It used to be a fairly unsophisticated market, and you know, these things would be announced on the front page of the paper, no question about it, right? But you have to be reading the paper every day. Mm-hmm. It just, they come and boom, that's an announcement. And there it is. Not even front page. It's like, you know, third page. Today, of course, there are websites that track this kind of stuff. And so there are people that run entire funds about merger arbitrage. So it's...
Yeah, same with stock splits. You can do a whole strategy on stock splits.
Whole stock split strategy, although I don't... It is absolutely something that works, but it's crazy. another one is spinoffs, which is a fabulous way to benefit. But today, the ability to do that is much more difficult than it used to be. And it's really difficult for somebody like Warren Buffett because he's got so much money. And these deals disappear quickly. The spread often just is gone as soon as there's an announcement.
Exactly.
You know, the stock is...
We don't see a lot of deals that blow up. It just doesn't happen that much. It happens occasionally, but not that much. If it gets to the point where it's publicly announced, it's a pretty solid deal.
Right.
And that's why I think we see the stock price just jump up the second it's announced. So...
Now, a couple of things. If you were to find out one of these things, what happens in today's market is that the stock price will jump straight up. So let's say the stock is currently selling for 15 and they announce it's going to be bought by a company ABC for 20. It, chances are, will go immediately to $20. Well, it goes to $19.93.
Right.
Now, as time goes along, though, and here's where the market starts to become less efficient, is people don't follow this, you know, religiously. They either jump in and get a piece of that deal or they don't, and then that's it. But what happens if the approval process starts to falter, or if one company starts to have issues, or if something happens, the deal starts to get shaky, then people who already own the stock of that company that's going to be bought out at $20 a share, those people start to get nervous that they're not going to be able to do this at $20, and they'll start to sell. They can sell. And as they start to sell, that price will start coming down, 1990, 1985, 1975. And this doesn't even have to be any big deal problems, just that we don't want to wait 6 months, right? Mm-hmm. To make that extra 25 cents. It's like, oh, whatever, I'll just take it now.
Take it and use it somewhere else.
Right on. So if you do track these things, often what is happening today, not often, but enough that it's worth looking at, is that the stock will hit that 20 or close to it and then start coming down if there's issues. And then if you look into it and you have an edge, that is, you understand the business and what the issues are, and the probability looks really good relative to the rate of return, then you might be able to do that deal. And we've seen a number of them that have actually worked out extremely well, where the stock basically went back down to 15, as if there was not going to be a merger. It was going to completely fall apart. Now, think about this for a second. If the stock was at $15 a share and it was reasonably priced at 15, in other words, not a on sale price necessarily, but it's absolutely what it's worth, then you don't have a downside here.
Meaning, right? If the deal falls through, right, you still bought it at the price that you would be comfortable with.
Exactly. And so part of figuring this all out is figuring out, what are you going to lose if you lose?
Mm, yeah.
So you got to know the various elements of this are, what's the probability of success? How long is it going to take? What do you lose if you lose? What do you win if you win?
Yeah. Well, it's like selling a call option on a company you want to own. What's the downside? You know, you're going to end up with some cash.
Selling a put option. Yeah.
A put option? I get them all mixed up. The one where you're forced to buy it. That's a call option, right?
It's a put option.
That's a put option. Okay.
Right.
So you sell a put option. Yeah, it gets put to you. Right. Okay. It's like that. Your downside is there isn't one. You either own the company you want to own or you keep the money that you got.
Right on. And if you're comfortable
with the downside is you maybe really did want to buy it or buy those shares and then you don't get to. That is a downside that can happen.
Well, yeah, but you get the 20% return or whatever, annualized, right?
Yeah.
So,
but not the 20-year amazing ownership.
That's the downside, and that's tough, and that's why we do a ratio puts sometimes. Where we'll, in fact, we did one of those on Whole Foods before Amazon bought it. Remember? Where we
don't remember that,
bought the stock and then sold puts against it in a ratio to the number of shares we owned. So for every share we bought, we sold 3 put options shares, and the premium was enough to drive the price of the shares we owned down below the margin of safety. So when Amazon bought the stock, if you'd done that, then you already own the stock at a margin of safety price. And if Amazon doesn't buy it and it drops down there to your put price, then you own it at a margin of safety price as well.
Hmm. So it's definitely really effective. Not involved in that, but that sounds interesting.
It's pretty slick, actually. It's a way of creating a margin of safety for at least a tranche of the portfolio, you know.
So overall, I hear you saying you can use your cash to generate some cash, hopefully.
Yes.
With risk. And understand that what you're doing is taking some risk with that cash, but do it prudently and hopefully we can come out with a little bit of a return, enough to keep up with what we would have lost maybe due to inflation.
Yep. And then Oliver, if you're working with a relatively small amount of capital, of course, that's obviously in the eyes of the beholder, but let's say $10,000 or $20,000, where you really want to do, what you're trying to do is build financial independence, then I would suggest looking very, very deeply into this possibility of doing speculation with a brain, right? There's certain ways you can do this. You can speculate using put options and call options. There's certain ways you can do it using merger arbitrage that will provide a really decent rate of return for the entire portfolio. I mean, if you do this right, you even if you do have a problem and you lose it, let's just say you did, you lost it, you're pretty, let's say you're 50 years old. I don't know, I have no idea. You sound like you're 25, but let's say you're 50 and you got $10,000. You're already broke, man. You're already broke. What is your downside of losing the $10,000? Honestly, it's not going to change your life dramatically, is it? I mean, you
feel uncomfortable with this. Let's leave it there.
I think Oliver should do
exactly what Oliver is comfortable with, and we have no idea what his situation is.
By the way,
is.
This is why CNBC put my pilot in the safe and won't let it out again.
Well, there you go.
Because of this kind of thing.
Great job continuing to say it.
People need to know that there are times in your life where risk is something
you have to take. That people need to know that they need to make their own financial decisions. And just because some dude on a podcast says something doesn't mean that you should do it. Right, Dad? Do you agree with me?
I want to say I agree.
Do you agree with me?
I do. And I also want to say that success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts.
Sick.
Winston Churchill.
I was going to say, somebody said that.
All right, we got to go.
Say it one more time. Take us out.
Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts.
Indeed.
I can just hear Churchill saying that. It's so cool. All right, you guys. That's how old I am.
Great question, Oliver. Thanks, you guys. We've got some more questions loaded up for next time. So we will talk to you then.
See ya. Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And it's really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.